This is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. It's Friday, February 15th. I'm John Wanamaker. A bill that would finance redevelopment around the Mayo Clinic's proposed expansion in Rochester is starting to move through the legislature. The House Jobs and Economic Development Committee approved the bill easily, but as Tom Scheck reports, the bill's financing plan is expected to face much tougher questions soon.
The members of the House Jobs and Economic Development Committee spent most of their time praising the bill and the Mayo Clinic's promise to invest in Rochester. Clinic officials again emphasized their promise to spend $3 billion to expand in Minnesota. In exchange, they won $585 million in public financing to help redevelop the city of Rochester. The Mayo Clinic's Patricia Simmons said the investment is needed to ensure that the Mayo Clinic continues to be a worldwide leader in healthcare.
We need to grow to succeed. We need to grow to maintain and to capture that historic Mayo Clinic we know, where we're the destination for healing and health and hope for so many people, people from 50 states, people from 145 countries of the world.
The plan relies on capturing a portion of future state and local taxes in Rochester. The mix would include personal and corporate income taxes, sales taxes, and property taxes. Supporters of the legislation say the money would be used for roads, transit, parking garages, and other improvements. The money could also be used to help build retail shops, multimedia infrastructure, and housing. The Mayo Clinic says the expansion will add between 35,000 to 40,000 jobs over the next two decades. Republican Representative Mark Uglum of Champlin was one of several lawmakers to praise the proposal because of the jobs it will bring.
This is a project that I think is probably exhibits some of the things that we need to do more in this state. And a public-private partnership with virtually no risk to the state's investment in this.
But others said there is plenty of risk. One member asked why some of the spin-off medical businesses that would benefit from the clinic's expansion aren't going to help fund the Rochester improvements. Others worried about the precedent that could be set if the bill becomes law. DFL Representative Tim Mahoney chairs the House Jobs and Economic Development Committee and is a co-author of the bill. The St. Paul lawmaker said Mayo's plan could open the door for other communities to lobby for a similar deal.
It opens up a huge Pandora's box, because if Rochester does it, why wouldn't St. Paul or Minneapolis or the transportation system or whatever do? I mean, we have $1 billion worth of infrastructure just in St. Paul to fix, and this would be a way to do it.
The committee unanimously approved the bill. It has several more committee stops before it reaches the House floor. Mahoney also warned that supporters of the legislation should expect the bill to get rolled into a larger tax bill. That could put some Rochester Republicans in a difficult position, because that tax bill will likely include tax increases to help balance the budget along with the Mayo expansion plan. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News, at the Capitol.
DFL Senator Al Franken appears to be on relatively firm ground as he faces re-election next year. 6 years ago this month, Franken launched his U.S. Senate campaign against Republican Norm Coleman. After a long recount, Franken won by just 312 votes. It looked like Franken would be an easy target in 2014, but at least for now, it's not playing out that way. Mark Zadeklik reports.
Republicans thought Al Franken would be a dream opponent. There was no shortage of material to use against the comedian and sharply partisan political commentator. When Franken won, many political pundits expected Republicans would be tripping over each other for a rematch. Former Senator Norm Coleman was expected to be the first in line to challenge Senator Franken. If not Coleman, many political observers thought former Governor Tim Pawlenty would be interested. But Coleman and Pawlenty have ruled out running, and with less than 2 years to go before the election, Franken is sitting on more than $1.2 million in campaign cash with no opponent in sight.
Senator Franken is in a surprisingly good position.
Catherine Pearson is a professor of political science at the University of Minnesota.
Franken looks harder to defeat than one would have predicted back in 2008.
In that 2008 campaign, Republicans and even some Democrats tried to frame Franken as offensive, angry, and polarizing.
The guys and I have been talking. We've read all this stuff about Al Franken, you know, not
this Coleman campaign ad featured three Joe Sixpacks contemplating Franken's candidacy at a bowling alley.
Tasteless sexist jokes and writing all that juicy porn.
Franken appears to have proven less polarizing than expected, although public opinion polls show him lagging behind DFLer Amy Klobuchar, the state's other senator. Klobuchar was reelected in 2012 with an almost unheard of 65% of the vote. A Star Tribune poll taken late last summer measured Franken's approval rating at 52%. Another poll from last month came up with the same number. A KSTP Survey USA poll released this month had Franken's approval rating at 47%, down from the others, but still 5 points higher than the 42% of the vote Franken won with in 2008. Catherine Pearson from the U of M says while Republicans might still dislike Franken, he's made inroads with other voters.
There's no doubt that he has improved his standing among Minnesotans. Republicans still are not big fans, if you look at the polling, but he holds ground with independents and moderates, and he has actually much higher standing among Democrats than he did 4 years ago.
I think that people had legitimate cause to think, okay, this guy, I mainly know him as someone who did comedy. And is he going to be serious?
In a recent interview with NPR News, Senator Franken said this when asked whether he thinks he's won over some skeptics.
You know, I have a lot of people come up to me and say, you're a lot better than I thought you were going to be. And I say, well, thanks for having had such low expectations.
While some Minnesotans apparently now view Franken in a more positive light, he's been something of a letdown to the National Press Corps. Alex Bolton covers the Senate for the congressional newspaper The Hill.
I was part of the great excitement and anticipation when the famed comic came to the Senate, and we were expecting Stuart Smalley impersonations and one-liners and lots of great comedic zingers to the press.
But that's not what Bolton and other Washington reporters got.
It's something that I think was very disappointing to reporters who expected to have a lively quote when Franken came to Washington. Al Franken has kept a very low profile here in Washington to the extent that he doesn't even talk to the national press.
Franken says he keeps a low profile by design, and he notes that while he avoids the national press, he does regularly speak with Minnesota reporters.
There is this sort of characterization of types of senators, and one is show horse and one is workhorse. And I always intended to be a workhorse. I was not there to grab press.
Franken has focused on health care, veterans, and privacy issues in the Senate. His voting record closely tracks Klobuchar's. Both supported the Affordable Care Act. Both have also voted to raise taxes on high-income earners. But that's where the similarity ends, says Republican Party of Minnesota Chairman Pat Shortridge.
I think the notion that Al Franken's in great position or Al Franken's going to be a shoo-in is utterly ridiculous. Al Franken is no Amy Klobuchar in most Minnesotans' mind.
Shortridge still believes Franken is a polarizing figure. Franken says partisanship is worse than he thought it would be on both sides of the aisle. But he's quick to point to Republicans with whom he sponsored legislation. Service dogs for veterans with Lindsey Graham. Diabetes prevention with Dick Lugar. Credit rating agency regulation with Chuck Grassley and Roger Wicker. Franken's crowning achievement so far was his push to include a provision in the Affordable Care Act that requires health insurance companies to spend as much as 85% of the premiums they collect directly on health care. Franken says the medical loss ratio, as it's called, is common sense.
That brings down the cost of health care because these companies now have to be more efficient.
According to a government report last fall, the requirement has already led to more than $1.1 billion in rebates for 13 million people. It will likely be a centerpiece of Franken's reelection campaign. Franken says he's enjoyed his time in the Senate and learned a lot since being sworn in. He says he's too busy to worry about his reelection and which Republican might end up running against him.
I really have no control over that. So what I do have control over is what I do every day. And I feel if I do my work, if I put my head down, use common sense, you know, stick with my principles, but one of my principles isn't don't compromise ever. If I do that, it'll all take care of itself.
U of M political scientist Catherine Pearson says Republicans would be smart to find a candidate to take on Franken sooner rather than later.
And this is further complicated by the fact that, of course, Governor Mark Dayton is also up in the same election. So Republicans are looking for two outstanding candidates to run statewide, people who can raise the money, have the name recognition, and get the campaigns together to defeat incumbents. It's a tough battle on both fronts.
Minnesota Republican Party Chairman Pat Shortridge says he's not concerned Republicans don't yet have candidates vying for Franken's job. He says there's plenty of time, and he predicts quality candidates will emerge.
I think Al Franken is a much more inviting target, as well as the election year 2014, a non-presidential year, is much more inviting than a presidential year in Minnesota.
In Minnesota, Democratic candidates typically do better in presidential election years than they do in off-year elections. And it's easy to argue that Franken could use some help. In 2008, when Franken won by just 312 votes, Barack Obama beat Republican John McCain in Minnesota by nearly 300,000 votes, more than 10 percentage points.
That's reporter Mark Zadeklik. Minneapolis South High School resumed classes today, one day after police broke up a fight involving hundreds of students. The school says it's implementing a safety plan to ensure, quote, a safe learning environment. Police used mace to break up the fight yesterday afternoon. Ambulances transported several people to the hospital. Police spokesman Sergeant William Palmer says no weapons were involved and all injuries were minor. Several students told NPR News that as many as 100 students got involved in the brawl. For 65,000 students in Minnesota, English is not their first language. The state spends $40 million a year helping those students learn English while they also study math, reading, writing, and so on. Governor Mark Dayton wants to boost funding for the state's English language learning programs in hopes of increasing student test scores. Tim Post reports.
This classroom at Chaska Elementary School is where students still learning English spend about an hour each day.
I corrected your spelling test, so you want to look and see how you did. Most of you did an excellent job.
Right now, teachers Mark Magnuson and Sarah Peterson are working with a dozen fifth graders on reading and writing.
You can even, sometimes I say what I want to write beforehand.
11-year-old Vladimir, everyone here calls him Vlad, has been in this class since he first came to the U.S. from Russia 2 years ago.
I only knew two words.
What were those two words?
Yes and no.
Vlad says his very limited English made it hard to answer even the simplest of questions from his teachers.
What is my name? I say no. And like no idea what they were speaking about.
But now Vlad's teachers say he's on his way to becoming proficient in English. Lisa Gilbert is English Learning Coordinator here in the Eastern Carver County School District.
The goal is that they are successful in school, that they can have a fighting chance, the same fighting chance as native English speakers.
Last year, the district spent $1.3 million on English language programs, but state and federal funding specifically for EL programs only amounted to $300,000. Gilbert says the district uses money from its general fund to cover the gap.
We hire teachers based on the needs of our students. And what we get from the state funding and federal funding for these students does not nearly cover what we spend on programming.
In his budget plan, Governor Mark Dayton proposes increasing state funding for English language programs by about $4.5 million a year. That's a 12% increase over current levels. Eastern Carver County School District officials estimate that could increase their EL funding from the state by $80,000 to $120,000. Chaska Elementary English language teacher Sarah Peterson says increased state funding could allow her to spend more time with English learners and possibly allow the school to hire another teacher.
So for us to be able to have that more time or another individual on staff would be wonderful. It would really service the kids in an effective way.
The state currently funds programming for English learners for 5 years. Dayton's proposed increase would expand that to 7 years. Minnesota Department of Education Commissioner Brenda Caselius says it's part of an effort to help the state's English learners do better in school.
By extending resources out a few more years, we think that that's going to really help them to achieve their standards and be able to read and do math on grade level.
English learners in Minnesota perform far below the state average in reading, math, and science, although there have been recent improvements in test scores. Only slightly more than half graduate from high school in 4 years. English learners make up 8% of the state's total K-12 enrollment, but their numbers are growing. And educators acknowledge that the number of immigrant students arriving with little or no formal schooling is growing as well. Students who come to Minnesota after living in a refugee camp, for instance, require more time to learn English. Martha Bigelow is an associate professor in the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota.
The longer time frame really does recognize that we have English learners in our state without prior schooling.
Minnesota lawmakers have yet to take up Governor Dayton's proposed increase for English language programs. It's part of a $640 million increase Dayton wants to see in the state's preschool, K-12, and higher education budgets. Dayton is proposing to fund the increased spending with higher income taxes on the state's top earners, a move even some members of Dayton's own DFL party aren't backing just yet. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News, Chaska.
This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Today, President Obama is honoring 13 people from across the country with the Presidential Citizens Medal. It's one of the highest honors bestowed on a U.S. civilian. One of the recipients will be Mary Jo Copeland, who 30 years ago started Sharing and Caring Hands in Minneapolis, helping the poor and the homeless. Mary Jo joined All Things Considered host Tom Cran before she took off for D.C.
Welcome and congratulations on the medal. This is quite an honor, isn't it?
I think it's a beautiful honor. It's a humble honor that I would be acknowledged for something I've done pretty much obscure. I mean, in the hidden. I've never been out much. I'm just pray and work. And all of a sudden, someone calls you up and they know who you are. I guess I was grateful for the opportunity to talk about the poor and what is really going on in our cities. And I was humbled, and I was grateful to God for that call. I really was, but I still a little bit taken by it. I mean, you know, you would be too if anybody called you from the White House. At first, yeah. I thought, wow, because, I mean, you don't expect anything like that. I mean, awards are nice, but the White House? Oh, come on.
You have a reputation for taking a real personal interest. Each morning, anyone new who comes in, you meet with them. You take a very hands-on approach here. Why is that aspect important to you?
Well, I think it's always been because I came down to help the poor. I can't just be sitting in my office, you know, like so many people that run places. As a director, you have to be a part of it, touch the people, talk to the people, find out what you can do, and then delegate it. When I see each person in that line, I say, well, what do you need? And then they run the Social Security number, but I'm still there listening to that story and then finding out what the story is, and having somebody else help them. But that's very important for a director of an organization, because people work with you, not for you.
Do you see a time where you may have to step back a bit from that role and let somebody else handle that, maybe other staff members or dare I mention even retirement?
Well, I think when I rest, I'll rest in eternity. There's no such a word as retire in my vocabulary. And as far as stepping down, I don't think I ever would. I think I'll probably die in the bucket soaking feet. No, but I mean, in reality, if my health is as good as it is and God continues to bless me with that health, I can continue to keep the energy level up. I want to be able to stay till I go to heaven. I'm trying to get there. I don't want to say I'm there. But I really want to stay there for as long as I can and be able to serve his people and be able to bring dignity to these people. You know, when people feel love, and not alone, Tom, they tend to come back to a place like that. So many hundreds of people. We're serving 800-900 people a day and 3 meals a day. So they, I like to touch that. I like to be a part of that. And the volunteers and the people that give their time and money, I'm there for them as long as I can be.
You yourself don't take a salary for your work.
I have never taken a salary, Tom. I came down not wanting to take anything for my work there. And then my husband came with me about 12 years ago. He used to be at Rainbow Foods. And then he took a salary. We had to have a place to live, Tom. I wasn't going to say, well, we could stay on the street. But but I've never wanted to. I've always told God that the money that came in there would go to the people. I don't feel, as a director, I should be taking in donors' money. I've never
felt.
And
you also don't take government funds, right?
Oh, I've
federal or state or
federal, state, United Way, nothing. And I think because of the fact that I have always never wanted to go by those rules. There is rules and regulations with all of these places once you start taking money. And also it sets me free to be that safety net. If someone needs a bus card, if someone needs whatever they need. Like I do a lot of eyeglasses for the schools. So the schools, the social workers call and say there's 10 kids over here that don't have eyeglasses. Well, I'm able to, I don't have to fill out paperwork saying, well, why are we going to help this child? If somebody calls from the school and says the kids can't see, they need to have glasses. We don't need to go to a committee to decide why they need glasses. So I do thousands of those a year. I do a couple hundred thousand a year in eyeglasses. Same way with beds in there. You don't have to sit down while you're giving a person a bed. If they're sleeping on the floor, give them a bed. So all those rules are free when you're not with government and all those agencies.
The number I have about what it takes monthly to run what you do is about $400,000 a month.
It's gone up about $450,000.
$450,000. Are there, and it's private donations entirely?
All private people, and people all come in and they can see it, they tour it, and it's come from businesses and attorney firms and law firms and just all these businesses that have heard about this. I think people want to give to something where they can see their money work. And it works there.
Do you see this work that you do as largely up to people like you who do it for whatever reason? Or do you think that the government has a hand here in doing some of this as well?
The individuals like myself in different cities, they can see people instead of papers and get things done quicker. I remember when George Bush was there, he said to me, he said, if this building and all you built here was in committee, it had never been done. So I really think it's going to take the private sector to do not all of it. Again, the government has to step in here. I mean, they have to make some provisions for some of the things that the private, the health and the housing, even building big shelters in some of our cities where people are dying on the street.
They're not there, although we do hear plans to end homelessness, public plans, and it's often in the news. But what don't those of us who aren't where you are, what do we not know about homelessness that you wish we did?
What I think people don't realize about homelessness is how down people get, how depressed people get, how people react to they don't want to come for help. Like I said earlier, through no fault of their own. So there's a side of people that they come in. I had a family come in the other day with three kids, a mother and dad, ashamed to be there. There's a side that it's
stigma.
Yeah, it is. We don't ask for help, Mary, but we had to come. And I'm glad I'm there to make them feel that they have hope. You know, hope is a funny virtue. I've always talked about hope. I'm going to tell the president too. I hope I can. Hope isn't just a wish or things will get better. Hope is a promise that we do not individually and as a world, as a nation, walk alone. We walk with people that care. We walk with a God that watches over all of us. Each one of us is spiritual in their own way. I mean, I'm a spiritual person, but we all are. And we know that God will take care of it. But we have to listen to that call. And it is hard. Another thing about homelessness people to understand is when people go through things, they sometimes get into drug problems, into drinking. There's a lot of mental health issues that come from that. And there's so many things to be addressed in that have to be taken care of. And I see it when they come to the building. They have no peace. They're just a wreck. They're there a little while, and the amount of atmosphere that can contribute to a person's peace and being a productive person is incredible. Like I had a lady tell me
this morning. The atmosphere of the people around
them? Yeah. In other words, the atmosphere of being in a place. See, this is transitional housing. They have their own stove and refrigerator. It's like an apartment. But I find the transformation so unbelievable because I do the intake. And they go down to the building, and I see a couple, 2-3 weeks later, people, I'm sleeping at night. I feel better. I get up in the morning. I'm not scared where I'm going to go. There's a peace in atmosphere that no one can take. But I wish I could put these places all over the country and say, give them atmosphere, and you'll see some productive people because they're not afraid anymore. They're full of peace, and they're full of security, and they're full of hope.
What would you like your mark to be in Minneapolis, your legacy?
My legacy, if I die, I want people knowing how important it is that they make the world better because they're in it, because they reach to the person around them. No matter how small it might be, whether it be taking a person to a car, to church, or buy them groceries, or there's all those things people can do, meals on wheels, so many things. Please look within your own neighborhood what you can do to make a difference, to bring the presence of God to people you meet. That's what I want to leave, in the power of prayer. Take the time to pray, no matter who you are, where you are. It doesn't have anything to do with religion. It has to do with a spiritual soul to just take their time with their God and say, what do you want me to do to make a difference while I'm here? So when I go, I make that difference. That's what I want to tell the people, that I hope my life and my life of faith has inspired other people to live that same life when I die.
Mary Jo Copeland, thank you for coming in today, and congratulations on the Citizens Medal at the White House, and best wishes with that ceremony.
Thank you very much for having me here, and thank you, President Obama. You're not listening, but thank you for letting me think I was worthy, and thank you for the community that have all supported this work for 30 years. Thank you, everybody.
And that's the NPR News Update for Friday, February 15th. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.